afternoon, everyone. So I want now to go back to the energy frontier. And over the past 40 years, the energy frontier has been dominated by colliders. When I arrived in CERN as a young fellow in 1969, the center of mass energy available for producing new particles was 7 GeV. That is the real center of mass energy of the CERN proton synchrotron. And now, when I retire in 2011, the center of mass energy is 7,000 GeV, and that on more or less a constant budget. And, of course, this is the power of the colliding beam device. For a fixed target machine, you're only increasing the square root of the energy. For the colliding machine, then the full energy is available. Now, this is something that probably you find very difficult to see, is the Livingston plot of colliders, where this axis is the time of first operation, the year of first operation, and this axis is the center of mass energy available. And there are two lines here. The lower line is the lepton line, E plus E minus, generally. And the upper line is the hadron line, of which there aren't many. I will talk about, of course, all four hadron colliders. There are many more electron machines, and there are good reasons for that. In 1960, Bruno Tuschek realized that you could turn a single ring into an electron-positron collider. And that idea, it was tried out in 1964. A small machine called ADA was built and worked. And electrons have several advantages. First of all, the positrons are relatively easy to make. You need low energy to produce them. But a key thing is the presence of synchrotron radiation. When you inject an electron beam or positron beam into a circular machine, it radiates synchrotron radiation, and this has got a strong damping effect, which basically damps down the beam size to an equilibrium value. And, of course, this is essential in order for getting the high density that you need to have a good luminosity with colliding beams. So I think the synchrotron radiation damping is a natural cooling available for leptons, which is brilliant, but it's also, in the end, it's its own demise, because the radiated power by synchrotron radiation goes as a fourth power of the beam energy. And this is a very difficult power law to beat. Eventually, I think LEP, the biggest machine ever built, reached 100 GeV per beam, and at that point it was radiating about 5% of its energy every revolution, and it was impossible to continue. So synchrotron radiation is a wonderful thing for producing these beams, but in the end it limits the potential in energy. Now, I want to show you this. I want to jump ahead a little bit. Now, this plot was shown by Maria Spiropoli in the plenary this morning. It's a sample of 3.1 inverse picobands of data taken from the LHC. The LHC is actually operating at this moment, and that amount of data is produced in 1.5 hours. And I want to show you the difference between hadron collisions and lepton collisions in discovery potential. Because these peaks you see, there are some Nobel Prizes in here. This is the JPSI. This is the Z0. And the JPSI was discovered, well, both at Brookhaven and at SLAC. But at SLAC, it was discovered by tuning the electron beam precisely to the resonance. I think that it needed a very precise scan, and of course the center of mass energy is perfectly well defined because the electrons are fundamental particles. And So in Slack, they had, let's say, the good luck or a machine powerful enough to be scanned along, not knowing where that resonance was, but finding it. There was a machine operating in Adone in Frascati at the same time, which was running just below this resonance. As soon as Slack found it, they called them and told them where to go. It meant pushing the machine into further into saturation, and then the counting rate exploded in the detectors, and they saw it also. Now, with hadron beams, of course, these are composite objects. What you are interested in is the collision between the fundamental quark-quark or gluons, and in any one collision, the central mass energy is not known. It has to be measured. So every collision is different. Therefore, the beam is a broadband beam. And these resonances, if you take enough data, this is a dimuon production, then these resonances will... It was not known where the Z0 mass was. It just popped out of the noise. It was not known where the top quark mass was in Fermilab, but it would be produced because the machine is a broadband beam. So I think hadron... machines have got their disadvantages in not precisely defining central mass energy, but as discovery machines, they certainly are superior. So I think that the start of the proton-antiproton collider probably began from the discovery of the electroweak theory, neutral currents at CERN, which gave an indication of the ballpark of what mass range the vector bosons should be. And in 1976, Rubio, Klein, and McIntyre proposed that either or both the CERN SPS and the Fermilab main ring should be converted into proton-antiproton colliders to emulate the electron-positron colliders, of course. But with protons, there is no synchrotron radiation damping. Or antiprotons. Antiprotons are hard to make. One needs substantial energy. And so there were a lot of difficulties in producing the beams. And the techniques for accumulating and cooling, especially, of the antiproton beams. Now, I think there is a theorem in accelerator theory, it's Liouville's theorem, which a lot of us have spent quite a large amount of our careers trying to beat. And that theorem basically says you cannot cool beams. In fact, what it specifically says that the phase space density of a particle beam cannot be changed under the action of conservative forces. So these are forces derived from a potential, electric magnetic fields, if the beam is considered to be a continuous medium. Electron beams, as I said, are naturally cooled by synchrotron radiation, which is non-conservative. And in the 1960s, Budka proposed the cooling of protons by their interaction with a cold electron beam. This was shown to work in Novosibirsk. But in 1972, from work done in 1968, Simon van der Meer at CERN discovered the principle of stochastic cooling, which actually makes use of the fact that the beam is not a continuous medium, that there are individual particles. Electron cooling works by having in a ring an electron beam, which is very collinear, very cool, and of course is recycled. So as the protons come along, they interact like Coulomb interactions with the electrons, giving transverse energy to the electrons, which are then refreshed, and every revolution, protons are cooled. The trouble with the electron cool, well, the good thing is it's fast. If it works, it's fast, but it's most suited for not low beta beams, but low energy beams, up until very recently at Fermilab. It's very effective for cooling heavy ions, and it is actually used to cool the lead ion beam for the LHC. But it's basically effective at cooling beams that are already pretty cold and was not good for cooling antiprotons directly from the production target, because the antiprotons are to be produced on the target. they want to pick up as much of the phase space as possible, and then you have to have a way of cooling them down and accumulating them. And the electron beam is not good as the primary source of that. Now, I want to say before PPBAR, a very important step in accelerator, in the accelerator world was taken in CERN in the intersecting storage rings. This was a proton-proton collider, the first proton-proton collider, and it taught us a number of important things. First of all, I mean, people... I remember I arrived in CERN as this machine was being commissioned, and very respected people had predicted that it would never work. It would never work because, unlike the electron machines, there was no synchrotron radiation damping, so that any tiny perturbation would accumulate and the beams would be lost. So it was a very important demonstration that you can make a machine work without any radiation damping. The machine did work, and it worked magnificently. There were pluses and minuses. On the minus side, I think a lot of physics was missed because the experimenters didn't know how to make detectors at that time for doing this kind of physics. So that was a great learning curve on the experimental side. On the machine side, we learned how to handle proton beams with no synchrotron radiation damping, pushing high vacuum to extremes, and, of course, the first demonstration of stochastic cooling, which is the key that opened the door to the PPBAR colliders. So the ISR was very important. Now, in the ISR, stochastic cooling was first observed. Schottky noise was first observed. Schottky noise is the incoherent noise of the beam, and it's the basis for the stochastic cooling. And this provoked Simon van der Meer to write a paper, and this is a Nobel Prize-winning paper, where his final note says, this work was done in 1968, and it was published in 72. The idea seemed too far-fetched at the time to justify publication. However, the fluctuations upon which the system is based were experimentally observed recently, and that is Schottky noise. Although it may be still unlikely that useful damping could be achieved in practice, it seems useful now to present at least some quantitative estimation of the effect. So he wasn't particularly convinced of his own idea. Fortunately, there were some brilliant engineers in the ISR who actually took up the idea, realized that the wideband amplifiers, power amplifiers needed to do this were now becoming a reality. And there was a demonstration of stochastic cooling in the ISR. This is the vertical beam size as a function of time when the cooling was switched on and switched off. And the effect was tiny, and the time was over many hours, a few percent change in the beam size. But nevertheless, it was there. It was real, and it worked. So this, I must say, this was due to the perseverance of the engineers, Wolfgang Schnell in particular, who took van der Meer's idea and made it a reality. Now, I think most people know how stochastic cooling works. If you have a circular machine, and suppose you have, first of all, one particle in that machine, it's performing Betatron oscillations around its orbit, and therefore, if you put a transverse pickup at its maximum orbit, and you put a kicker where... 90 degrees phase advance where this is at its maximum transverse amplitude and this is where it's crossing the axis. You send a signal across the ring, of course, synchronous with the particle coming around. You give it a kick and then the particle is dumped onto its orbit. If you have a ring full of particles, then if you could imagine infinite bandwidth, then you could do that to each one individually. Infinite bandwidth is impossible, so all you will see in the pickup is the average of a sample, and that average of a sample would be less as the bandwidth is increased. And if you've got a sample of n particles with a standard deviation of sigma, then the mean is sigma upon root n, so you would be continuously correcting the mean. Now, what is not intuitive is at all is that if you keep correcting the mean under certain conditions, then the standard deviation will go down. And this is what Van der Meer realized. The conditions are that they should be, you want to perfectly, you want to see the same signal when you correct, but of course, if you only see that, then by the next time you come around, it's gone. There's got to be a mixing between the kicker and the pickup, so a new distribution is reestablished all the time. And this produces a damping of the transverse beam size. Not completely intuitive, but fairly easy to show. So this now led to taking these things together, the ideas of Rubbia and collaborators, to try to convert one or both of the big fixed target machines into storage ring, emulating electron positron, using cooling. In 1977, then things really started to move. That's when the G-2 ring, for the ring that was made for the magnetic moment of the muon at CERN, was converted into a machine on which stochastic cooling could be tested in detail. And in parallel, the theory of cooling was developed by a number of people to a very sophisticated level. In 1978, the ICE, Initial Cooling Experiment, a nice acronym, achieved cooling for the first time in all three dimensions. And in June, the PPBAR project was submitted to the CERN Council for approval. And this is a picture now. I mean, it's not only, I mentioned transverse cooling, but you also have to cool the momentum spread. And this is a picture in ICE. We're not talking about hours anymore, as the ICE are. In a few minutes, the momentum spread is being compressed and the density increased in the beam. And this was the big step forward in getting acceptance for the project by the CERN Council. On the other side, in Fermilab, Fermilab was in a different situation. Fermilab was in the middle of the construction of the doubler, now the Tevatron, which of course was the world's first large superconducting machine. And in November 1978, I think it was called the Armistice Day Shootout, so there must have been blood on the floor. It was decided that the best strategy would not to try to compete with CERN in converting the main ring at the time into a collider with everything else was going on, that the top priority should be getting the Tevatron finished, and the colliding beams would be in the Tevatron and not in the main ring. I don't think it would have ever worked in the main ring. The vacuum was nowhere near good enough, and field quality, etc. So that was a very wise decision. I think that paved the path. Of course, it gave the W and Z to CERN, but paved the path for the first big superconducting machine. And also the great discoveries at higher energy, especially the top quark. This is a picture. I'm sorry, I've only got pictures from CERN because it was easy to get my hands on, but of course in Fermilab it's the same, of the antiproton accumulator. So antiprotons were produced at CERN from 26 GeV protons on a target and then captured with either a horn or with a lithium lens. And then injected into an accumulator ring where they were cooled. A second ring was added later on. Initially, they were cooled and accumulated in one ring. Now there was a second ring added, and in Fermilab, there is even a third ring where these antiprotons are stored. And you can see the lines going across in order to send the signals from pick up to kicker. So I think the acceleration and stories of these intense proton and antiproton beams created many problems, which had to be resolved, and basically with the prototypes on which the LHC design is based. These included beam stability, RF noise, intra-beam scattering, and especially the beam-beam interaction, which was a big, big headache. And I will not go into this in much detail, but this is an old-fashioned chart recorder output with time on this axis. And this is the horizontal and vertical tunes. This one comes from the SPS, but as I say, in Fermilab, the results are exactly the same. That there are very high-order resonances which are generated not by the magnetic imperfections, but by the beam-beam interaction, the non-linearity in the beam-beam interaction itself, which excite the particles to large amplitude and get lost if they sit on these resonances. You can see a scan through these resonances, and you can see what you see here is a strong proton beam and a weak antiproton beam. So the proton beam, this is basically the slope of this, is the lifetime. As you scan through the resonances, the proton beam isn't being affected at all because the beam-beam force is very low, and the antiproton beam is being strongly affected because of this strong nonlinearity. And this imposes severe constraints on the quality of the control of the tune, etc., and also imposes in a PP bar beam separation, which is also very complicated. And again, this comes from the SPS. In Fermilab, it's much more complicated. So what you see, in the SPS, there were 6 bunches per beam, so they would collide in 12 points and produce a very large tune spread. And the lifetime is very bad, extremely bad. And there are electrostatic separators which can produce an orbit. So this is the orbit. It is about 5 millimeters. And produce an oscillation in the orbit in opposite, because it's electrostatic, it's in opposite direction from protons and antiprotons. So the beams are missing each other in the unwanted crossing points. And as you bring them up, then you see the lifetime gets much, much better. At Fermilab, it's not a simple system like this because there are many more bunches than in the SPS. In fact, the beams are separated in both planes and they perform helical orbits. So altogether, that's an electrostatic separator. Altogether, I think PP bar is extremely difficult and demanding. A big innovation at Fermilab was the actual implementation of electron cooling. I said electron cooling is good for low energy. In Fermilab, it has been successfully used to cool 8 GeV antiprotons, which have already been cooled stochastically, so they're already quite cold. But, I mean, this has been, and it needs 4.34 MeV electrons to be synchronous with the 8 GeV antiprotons. Coming from a recycling electrostatic machine. And this has been used to increase the phase space density of the antiprotons to a point where the Tevatron has reached a performance that I would never imagine would have been possible. So this is the improvement of the performance of the Tevatron, bringing on especially the third ring and the cooling, electron cooling of the stochastically cooled beam. And you see luminosities of 4 times 10 to the 32 would have been unimaginable. I think the PP bar collider at CERN was designed at 10 to the 30 and just exceeded it. And you see this marvelous performance here. Of course, it's very difficult. During the time that the Tevatron is taking data, then antiprotons are being made and cooled. And, of course, the number of antiprotons available for the next injection into the Tevatron is a function of how long the previous store lasted, for example. So there is a big variation in fill-to-fill, which is inherent in the proton-antiproton collider. But I think the accumulated luminosity, I mean, of more than 10 inverse femtobands from the Tevatron, showed what can be done with the ingenuity and the dedication of the people there. So, the LHC. Of course, we looked at the LHC as a PPBAR collider in order to save money. But in the end, of course, the very high luminosity needed is not just not achievable. Unreliability is just not achievable. So the LHC is once more a two-ring machine where you see the two apertures, superconducting coils, and the two apertures in a very compact structure and also a very high field of more than 8 tesla in its final, in the final form. Back to proton-proton again. And this makes life enormously simpler. In the proton beams are readily available and predictable. So it makes for a much, much easier operation. And now the LHC is operating at a comparable and slightly higher luminosity than the Tevatron. So I just want to conclude. I think that the developments leading to the successful conversion of the two high-energy accelerators to PPBAR colliders has taken the art of manipulating and controlling particle beams to a new height and have made the most fundamental discoveries of the at least the last quarter of the 20th century, the W, the Z, the top. And even now, I think there is a big sample of data still to be analyzed at Fermilab and some tantalizing indications, but there we will see what comes of it. The lessons learned have been absolutely essential for the design of the LHC, both in the design and the operation of a superconducting machine, and of the fundamental processes like the beam-beam interaction, what can be achieved was directly fed into that design. However, due to the need for an increase of two orders of magnitude in luminosity, the use of antiprotons is no longer an option. I think the final closure of the Tevatron will end an exciting and productive chapter in the development of accelerator technology, and I think it's been a tribute to all the people who worked on PPBAR for their ingenuity in making all this work at all. So thank you very much. Yeah, first of all, I think that the Fermilab ring, it had problems with vacuum, problems with field quality, as far as the for a collider is concerned. Maybe those could have been solved, but I think the fundamental thing was that the Tevatron was going full blast, and I think that. You know, the internal discussions that led to that decision, I wasn't part of. But it certainly was the correct thing to do. I think they would never have competed with the SPS with everything else that they had on.
Yes. I think you forgot to mention another beautiful contribution of Van der Meer. When the ISR started, initially, people had no idea how to measure.
Dusty, yes.
He came up with a beautiful, simple idea.
That's right, yeah, which we do all the time now.
Yes. Comments?
I'd like to ask a naive question.
Yep.
Has anybody looked into more efficient production of antiprotons?
More efficient production? There isn't any magic. I mean, you need to get a high enough center of mass energy to produce them, and the CERN was limited to 25 JeV. The Fermilab goes higher. you need to have the most efficient collection way at all. At first, at CERN, for the first few years, we used another van der Meer invention, which was a horn, a tiny horn compared with the neutrino horn that we all know about. And then both CERN and Fermilab changed to another invention that came from Novosibirsk, actually, as well as of electron cooling, was lithium lenses, and lithium lenses are being used now. I don't think that there is much more that can be done.
There are no more questions. Let's thank you.